and welcome to Untold, the podcast where we go behind the scenes to discover some stories of the times when things didn't quite go to plan. Our aim is to get as many people talking about these as possible, to let others know that it's okay to go through some tough times. Today's guest is an absolute legend of the Challenger brand world, someone I have had the distinct pleasure of working for in a previous role, Mr. Mark Palmer.
Mark is a fascinating individual and a real stalwart of the food and drink industry. He has had roles, marketing director for Green and Blacks, and also Press & Manger. He's co-founder of Caused & Press, a fantastic soft drinks company, and LA Brewery, an up-and-coming kombucha brand. He's also chairman of Union Coffee, among other roles. I am incredibly excited to welcome him onto the show. Mark, welcome.
Hi there, Harry. Good to see you. And hi, Mariana.
The way that we normally sort of kick these things off is if you give us a couple of minutes about your career. I know I've introduced you, but I don't think I've done it justice. So it'd be great to hear about the wonderful span of your career.
Thank you. Well, you've covered a few things on the CV. I guess my career's all been spent in food and drink with some of the businesses that you mentioned. My earlier career was more with bigger companies, starting with United Biscuits, working on their KP snacks side of things, and then moving to a marketing role at Burger King. And then I guess halfway through my career, I began my transition into more entrepreneurial emerging businesses, firstly Green and Blacks, when it was a very specialist natural food, natural chocolate company. So made the move there, much smaller business, and then a stint as marketing director of Pret. Pret, obviously a much bigger business, but private equity backed, and looking to transition from sort of founder managed really to keeping the magic, but scaling up pretty fast under private equity backing. So that was an exciting stage. And then I do seem to have a career habit, really. When anything gets kind of big, I tend to do a runner and go and join something smaller again and see whether I can help it to grow. So I think if I reflect, that's probably my sweet spot. I mean, it's fair to say I wouldn't classify myself as an out-and-out founder who has taken some of the risks that some of your guests have done listening to the other podcasts. But I've worked with some great founders and alongside some great founders, and I hopefully tried to help some promising businesses go to the next level and scale up.
Absolutely fantastic. Well, brilliant. No, it's very exciting. As you know, at Untold, we try and focus on the things that haven't necessarily gone to plan, and potentially the kind of effect that it has on a founder or business leader's mental health. And the idea behind it is to get more people to talk about it and to know that it's okay to talk about it. Everyone goes through different issues at different kind of timelines in their career. And I know that our guests are going to be fascinated listening from someone of your experience about those times. So I guess if we crack on, and I'd love to hear about time or sometimes, as we spoke about before, where things haven't necessarily gone to plan.
Okay, so I've had to think about this, and I thought the best thing to do was to just call out a few examples from different companies. So I'm going to talk about something very early on in my career when I was at KP, then move on to, I guess, a phase at Green & Blacks, which is actually a phase after we sold the business to Cabrian, to describe that transition, because I think that's an interesting moment for founder entrepreneurs around what do you do once you've achieved the exit that you've been shooting for many years. Yeah. What does life look like after that? And in my case, it didn't look like leaving the business. It involved staying with it for the next stage. So some reflections on that. Yeah. And then more recently, my time at Pret, and just describe a sort of, I guess, a meltdown moment there almost around, which was a mix of personal and business overload, should we say, all hitting at the same time. But if we start with KP, so some of your older viewers will remember these times. We'll take you back to the mid-90s, so it's kind of Oasis and Blur and Take That dominating the charts. And I think we were sort of, football was coming home. It was Euro 96, just to try and put people into the time. And I was brand manager of Hula Hoops at KP. And back in the day, I mean, it's still a successful brand, but Hula Hoops was £100 million retail sales value brand. It was the biggest savory snack brand in the country, I think only second to Walker's Crisps in terms of savoury snacks and crisps at that time. So very, very big established brand, perhaps at a time where there were fewer challenger brands on the scene. But It was a great privilege and honour to work on that brand. I joined KP as a graduate trainee, having done a placement year with them. I kind of rejoined them on their graduate training scheme in 1994, and got to spend some brilliant time there, really learning from some fantastic quality business people, and in particular marketing people at that company. And they ran very, very good training and gave you the chance to work on a number of brands in the business. So I did my time on the likes of Choc Dips and Space Raiders and Skips, and then had a stint on McCoy's and Mini Cheddars throughout my period at KP. But probably the peak time for me there was being brand manager of Hula Hoops. I had a fantastic boss at the time, a guy called Nick Canning, who's still a great friend today, and learned absolutely huge amounts working directly for somebody like that. And it was quite, to be honest with you, it was being a youngster learning the ropes in a marketing team that there were about 24, 25 people in marketing at KP at the time. It was a real powerhouse of a business. And it was quite rock and roll, or as rock and roll as marketing goes back in those days. So we were working with some of the world's best creative agencies, whether that was design or advertising. We worked with the likes of Publicis on advertising and Design Bridge, Billings and Cartmel and Marketing Drive on sales promotion. Some really well thought of agencies with some very talented people. I got very early experience of making things like TV ads, which was very exciting, and got to meet Harry Enfield and Paul Whitehouse, who were the stars of the Hula Hoops ads back in the day, who were ranting about why people must never change the shape of hula hoops because they'll be around forever. And some just big stuff to work on early on in a career. And certainly KP promoted the idea of marketing, as I always say to people, that's kind of where you learn to be managing director or a mini managing director of your brand. So you're dealing with a factory, you're dealing with the finances, you're presenting to the sales team, you're managing a roster of very talented agencies and creatives. You're really at the kind of center of the operation. And it was just a brilliant, brilliant time. It was quite a good party scene, because it was marketing at the time seems to be even more exciting than it is today. So the agencies were forever sort of throwing great bashes. And I remember actually was very fortunate to go to some of the Euro 96 games, courtesy of one of the ad agencies. And it's almost as if life couldn't get much better, to be honest, career-wise at that point. And I seemed to be doing well, and the occasional pay rise and plenty of kind of recognition, but it was just great to be a part of that scene. And then I was about to head off on a holiday. And just before I left, I got kind of called into the marketing director's office, which was pretty scary at the time, to be asked to go and see the big boss, a lady called Jude Bridge, who was marketing director at the time. And Jude said to me, "Sit down, I've got some good news for you. We think you're making even faster progress than we hoped. We really like having you here. So we want to give you some more money." And I thought, well, this is brilliant. Just before holiday, kind of another pay rise. And we're actually going to promote you to senior brand manager, which was quite a landmark. And that meant you got your company car and an early stage Nokia mobile phone, kind of like a Wall Street-esque mobile phone back in the day.
Amazing.
And you got the kind of keys to the company car. So I think the three of us at the time were sort of promoted, and I think we were the only three people that in a row in Twickenham, where we were based, were all driving Ford Pumas. They were sort of first off the production line, and all the marketing team had Ford Pumas. But it was kind of all quite exciting. And then just so I was about to leave, you know, I've got another piece of news for you, which is actually we're going to change your job. So you've done well on Hula Hoops, and we've noticed that. But this promotion comes with a job move. And Hula Hoops was sort of the top job there, really, I thought. And then she said, "The job you're going to do is you're going to be senior brand manager, but you're going to be responsible for own label snacks." So selling snacks into the supermarkets. And I thought, this is like going from playing for a Champions League club to kind of going down several levels. It's nowhere near as exciting or as glamorous as I thought it might be. And I went off on holiday and literally came back and had 1 week of handover with a good friend at the time who was taking my job over on Hula Hoops. So I was then sort of, I felt like I'd sort of been cast adrift, really, to go and do own label. And I just found it very, very difficult to come to terms with that particular job move. Looking at it now, it's kind of ridiculous that I feel that way. It was a fairly trivial thing. And actually, they had my best interests at heart, which were getting me broader career development. And they felt that by doing a stint on Own Label, I would learn some new skills. But at the time, it felt like a massive kind of body blow, to be honest, and a real hit to my motivation and morale. And yeah, I was pretty down in the dumps for a while until I kind of got to grips with that with that role. And then through that role, in a very short time, you realize actually life's pretty good, and there are some new things to learn here, some new tricks and some new people. Got to hang out with accountants and factory people much more than previously. Learn how to understand things like cost of goods and margin calculations. Got to go and see retailers and be kind of see at first hand how big negotiations went around Own Label crisps contracts and the like, which was all good experience.
Yeah.
Learn how to do Lotus 1-2-3, which, if you've not heard of it, was the forerunner to Excel back in the day.
Lotus 1-2-3. I have not heard of it.
Have you not? Oh my God, the most frustrating thing ever.
Yeah, very frustrating. But and certainly for a marketing person at the time, learning how to use a spreadsheet like that was quite a challenge in itself. So kind of learned some good things, but as I say, sort of you feel like you're just really your career's on the rise. And actually my career, it was going well, and it was their way of helping me go even further, but it just didn't feel like that at the time. But I only raise that in case there are people listening to the podcast that are earlier in their career. And you know, my reflection at the time is, at the time was quite, you know, I'm quite a downer about that, but looking back, it just taught me that you need to you know, see it all as a journey, really, where you can gain different experience from different roles. And one of my more recent bosses once said to me, you should always have your, try and have a 5-year personal plan. And when you're looking at a decision around your career, don't just look at the role that you're being offered or that you're doing, but think about how that's going to help you get to the role after that, which might be the one that you really want. So it's more a reflection on career progress and having, I guess, kind of been on fire, so to speak, and seen the glamorous side of marketing. I kind of had to do a different stint for a while, but it was, if I look back now, it's probably a very big part of some of the opportunities I've had since were only really possible because of that experience. So that was an early reflection of marketing careers, different obviously to some of the challenges that founders have, but nonetheless still quite a challenge. And I think we all need a bit of patience maybe, and to put things in perspective.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And I think especially the sort of younger guys coming through now and constantly wanting to jump and move and constantly sort of almost moving businesses to jump up again is becoming more and more prevalent. So it's really interesting to hear that actually
looking back, I was fortunate to work on a sort of, you know, name in lights type role brand early on, but then to have that taken away was it was for the good in the long term. But yeah, it was a little bit tough at the time. So onto there, I guess, to talk about a phase at Greener Blacks, the chocolate company. I spent around 8 years at Greener Blacks, joined the business when it had recently been refinanced, and the original founders had sort of stepped aside, sold most of their interest in the business and taken on an ambassadorial type role. But a new team arrived, the former management team, CFO and CEO from New Covent Garden Soup Company, sales director, who's a family relative of yours, Barry, so you know him well, an ops director. And I was hired as the last member of the team to do the marketing. And our job was to really grow Green and Blacks. We had a number of private shareholders that had injected some funds into the business, and we wanted to see whether we could slightly alter the positioning of the brand to move it away from what at the time was quite a minority niche positioning around organic and ethical, to really take advantage of the great tasting chocolate that Greener Blacks always had and make it, you know, of broader appeal and make it grow much faster in the wider industry. So I can only describe it as the happiest and I think most successful period of my personal career. We had an amazing team, amazing culture, quite a small team, sort of 20 people. But we just grew so fast, and we did all sorts of innovation. Not all of it worked. We were kind of a proper challenger brand in terms of the comms. talk of the town really back in the day. I think Green and Blacks was a bit like an Oatley of today. It really was a trendsetter, yeah. And it was a much admired challenger brand. And along the way, we attracted plenty of interest from the industry. We took on an investment from Cadbury, who bought a very small stake in the business to start with, took a seat on our board in an advisory capacity, non-executive seat, and then had some rights to acquire more shares later if we did well. And as it happened, we actually did way above the plan that we set, which isn't always the case. It was a great outcome, and they decided that they would take up those rights and acquire all of the business, which they did in 2005, I think summer of 2005. So that was the kind of exit moment that I guess most founders, and I was not one of the original founders at Green and Blacks, but most management teams and founders kind of dream of, the big exit. And I didn't feel that way about it. I felt like I just was so loving the job, a bit like the hula hoops moment. And all of a sudden, why did this have to change, really? It's like I couldn't have been happier with the job and that I had and the people that I was working with and wanted it to carry on. So a few people left the business at that point. My senior colleagues, not everybody, but there was an advisory board set up, which the original founder, Craig Sams, and our CEO, William Kendall, sat on, and I was part of that. Neil, who was our sales director, moved to run the American business, and John, our ops director, decided to sort of develop his career outside of the business. So day to day, I was kind of the last remaining full-time person in the UK for Green and Blacks of the old guard. And I guess I felt a personal responsibility to look after the brand. As I say, I wasn't the founder, but it sort of felt like my baby at that time, and I wanted to see it thrive under the new ownership. And brands go through a period, and culture, I think, goes through a period of great risk when ownership changes. And I just felt we had a lot of things really right there. It was a very special time and wanted to make sure it continued. So I guess I went from being part of a team that were firing on all cylinders to suddenly being left holding the baby, probably a bit of an extreme description, but I did feel very personally responsible for it. And all of a sudden, I felt my job was to protect the brand in the bigger world where it operated. And it was fine for a while. Fortunately, the brand continued to grow phenomenally well, so that, you know, the numbers were good, which always helps. And then I guess over a period of time, it just became more difficult. And Cadbury had some great people at Cadbury who'd spotted the brand originally, a guy called Mark Reckitt, who sat on our board as the non-exec from Cadbury, who remained involved, sort of fell in love a bit with Green and Blacks and took great care over it in terms of the stewardship of the brand. So he was always trying to do the right thing. And then we had a series of new joiners from Cadbury, and getting a job at Green and Blacks was viewed as a sort of like a sexy secondment. So if you're at Cadbury, you come and work on this trendy upcoming brand. And through that process, I guess we had some really talented people join that helped us, particularly the finance director, a guy called Ian McMillan, who came from Cadbury to join the business, since gone on to do many great things. He's now the CFO of Bourne Leisure, and before that was at Sainsbury Argos as the UK FD, but a super talented guy. Again, got to know the business before they acquired it, came in, took us to the next level in terms of analytics and finance know-how, but really was a great addition to the team and culture. So we saw some good people coming across. To be honest, all the people that came across were good people, but I would say not all of them adjusted to the Green and Blacks culture and the environment that we had. And it became a little troublesome over time, and a bit frustrating. I found it very frustrating when some of the corporate behaviors started to almost invade an entrepreneurial culture, not because people were out to do the wrong thing or cause any trouble, but just because they found it probably very stressful, to be honest, being in a more entrepreneurial environment, because it wasn't really what they were used to. So we had a few instances where, rather than a culture of let's be up and at it and see what we can achieve and really shoot for the stars, that things like forecasting certainty became almost the driving force and was more important than, well, it almost wasn't really very good if you beat forecasts, because actually it was different to what you said you were going to do. And I always found that extremely difficult to deal with that type of sort of stakeholder management kind of corporate behavior, which, you know, challenger brands can't work like that. And Green and Blacks wasn't ready to become a big brand. It was still a challenger brand. And I found that personally quite troubling. And then things like, innovation starts to be looked at differently with a very risky lens. Individual innovation has to hit minimum hurdle rates, which were probably very appropriate to a big cabby factory, but completely irrelevant to an outsource model like Green and Black's. But trying to sort of mesh the two systems and cultures together caused a few bumps, it'd be fair to say, and a few fallouts. And I found that I almost felt I was representing the brand, but also the previous team, and trying to do the right thing for everybody, really, and not always pleasing any of the parties involved. In that, you've got a lot of people in your ear from the old guard, and also then the new shareholder trying to do their thing. Everybody with good intentions, but I felt like I was sort of stuck right in the middle of it, and it was quite an unhappy time. But the business was still kind of motoring and, you know, doing very, very well.
How do you, for our listeners out there, in terms of sort of losing that culture or feeling like the culture is sort of slipping away from you, how did you go about trying to keep it together? What sort of tangible elements were there that you could kind of bring that challenger brand to somebody that has come from a corporate backing and therefore so it doesn't necessarily come naturally to them?
Well, I think, you know, the perfect answer is to try and blend the best of both together. And I think, you know, we managed to do that to a large extent. I would say for the first 18 months, 2 years, we did that very, very well. Cadbury, to their credit, were extremely, I mean, they were very concerned about piling in and disrupting the sort of, you know, the magic dust, if you like, that had made Green and Black's better. They were really, really careful about that. But I think they started to sort of, I wouldn't say enforce, but encourage some synergies or some ways of working that were just, I felt, counterproductive. So I think you have to embrace the good parts, but also fight for some of the entrepreneurial behaviors. And if you try and keep everything the same, you're probably not going to win that. Equally, if it tips too far too quickly to the in the other direction, that's not always helpful. So I guess the skill for the entrepreneurs who are trying to transition and navigate that change is to, you know, wholeheartedly welcome certain changes where you know people can bring added value skills and do things perhaps better than we could ever imagine for. And that definitely happened, I would say, in some functions. But then you need to stay very firm on some other topics, maybe product quality, maybe the approach around marketing and innovation, you know, research, trying to get good insights and take advantage of data and relevant market insights, but not be a slave to them. And I think big companies tend to do it the other way around. You know, they're just overladen with huge amounts of research coming out of their ears and not a lot of decision making. And it dampens the entrepreneurial spirit. And I've had a theory for some time. People in big companies often are not really rewarded for making bold decisions. They're almost, you get promoted if you don't make a decision, but you don't do anything wrong. If you do something right and you've gone out on a limb, it's pretty unusual. So, you know, many people tend to play it safe. So as I say, no one had a mission to destroy anything or make it bad, but it just over time became quite tough to keep the challenger spirit going. And of course, more people wouldn't say jump, you know, not everybody abandoned ship, but for some people working for a bigger company wasn't their scene and they wanted to go and do it again on other businesses, and good for them. You know, the right thing that they chose to do that. So the balance just sort of tips over time, I think, and it was that phase. So anyway, we kind of, the guy who was the CEO of the whole of Cadbury Group at the time, an American guy called Todd Stitzler, who'd been involved in the acquisition of Green and Black's and was a fan of the brand, although colleague once told me, it's a good job you like your chocolate because based on your financials, you're a rounding error. Which I never quite recovered from that assessment of progress. Probably technically correct from an accounting point of view, but not the best morale boosting speech I've ever received. But for Todd always said, remember when they bought the business and we had the kind of everyone invited to Berkeley Square, which is the head up in Mayfair, was the head office of Cadbury at the time. And we kind of had the congratulations kind of signing ceremony and glass of fizz to celebrate them buying the brand, which is all great. But he said, you know, we really need to keep the spirit of this business going because it does a lot of things that we're not very good at. And that's why we're interested in working with you. And there's anything you think we're doing that's really going to fuck this thing up, then just give me a call because I need to know. So I always remembered that. And
yeah,
you know, a few years down the track, I thought I've just had enough of this. I'm kind of trying to solve this on my own. So I, over a number of evenings, I'm embarrassed to say, because I drafted it so many times, I wrote the equivalent of a sort of Jerry Maguire kind of letter. If you've ever seen the Jerry Maguire movie where he writes this massive ranting letter. And I did have to edit it a few times to calm it down, but it was fair to say supercharged with emotion. And, you know, I really cared about that business, but probably maybe wasn't thinking as clearly as one might do in those situations, you know, a bit emotionally charged. And anyway, I eventually pressed send and got a call back from Todd's PA saying he's got your email and slightly surprised by it, but would you like to come in and see him? Can you come in tomorrow morning? So he'd like to like to buy you breakfast, but you need to turn up at 7:15 or something a.m. at Berkeley Square. I thought, this isn't looking good. So anyway, got the number 22 bus from Putney all along the King's Road into Mayfair and up to Berkeley Square, and one of the first people to arrive there up to the top of the building to the CEO's kind of office area. And he sat me down and he said, I don't get many emails like that, so I thought I should see you. I think this is really going badly. And he said, look, he said, first and foremost, thanks for writing it, because he said, the problem with being CEO of a big company like this is no one ever tells me what's really happening. So he said, everybody just bullshits me and doesn't tell me what's actually going on. Yeah. So it's actually helpful to learn. But he said, I wasn't massively enamored with some of the things you were describing. And obviously, he said, I'm probably going to discount, let's call it 35 to 40% of your content, just because you're feeling very raw and it's emotional. I understand that. But so I'm just going to kind of assume that some of this is a little bit exaggerated. Let's take 40% off the table. But the other 60%, he said, I understand there's something there and we should talk about it and we should do some things. We should work together to fix these things. And to his credit, he sort of heard me out and we made some changes after that. Amazing. Changes to the way the businesses operated together, the level of contact, the approach around a few topics, and indeed personnel. And we gave it another go. And I think it was good to clear the air. With hindsight, probably shouldn't have had to go to the CEO of 1.6 billion, whatever they were, turn over the company at the time to make those points. But I felt that kind of people that were perhaps in role at the time weren't really listening or getting it. And that was my kind of way of dealing with it, because it was causing me a lot of angst and upset. Was to go right to the top, really. And I don't think you do those. You don't take that approach every day, and you have to use those moments very sparingly. But they can be powerful if you do them from time to time. And getting things off your chest, I think, is the most important thing. If you just let things build up and build up, and I've probably done that for, I don't know. I mean, those people that know me probably said that I'd been winding me up for best part of 2 years, not 2 months. Wow. It was a cumulative build of stress. And, you know, I'm not saying I was entirely right about all those topics. It was probably part of it was me being over defensive about a culture that had sort of needed to move on and a brand that was trying to go through the next stage of ownership. But I do think there was probably some good points in there. And it was wise that Cadbury and their sort of leader at the time were open enough to listen, and I thank them for doing that, because I think it helped them and us move things on to the next level.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, it's amazing to know that so it gave you the time and really talked through it and genuinely cared as well, which is really, must have been a really good feeling at the time.
I think often, you know, you assume people kind of just have an agenda or are out to do the wrong things. In my experience, it's rarely the case. It's just often the, you know, it's the clash of cultures or measurement of things that causes these sort of moments of discomfort to build up, really, and tension to escalate. And everyone's probably trying to be professional and do their best, but I just felt, I guess, I'd kind of lost my peer group, and I had a tight relationship with my other kind of exec team members or, you know, board members when Green and Blacks was independent. They'd all gone off to do slightly different things, and I definitely felt that I was sort of the the last one standing almost.
I felt
more pressure in that time period, although the brand was doing very well, than I ever felt when we were independent. And to be honest, some of the times early on when we were independent were much more hairy. We were running out of cash and stuff was going wrong in the business, and we were being delisted and listed, and then we had Easter eggs smashing when they weren't supposed to smash, and supply chain fails, all the fun and games that sound more like a founder life. That probably, to be honest, in terms of their impact on the business were much greater, but we kind of had such a great spirit that we all were together and sorting those things out. And I felt for a period of time that wasn't as tight, and I didn't have the people around me day to day to kind of share those pressures with and to thrash through the solutions. So that was some good learnings. And I think one of the other things I'd reflect on from that is just how corporates, at least, and indeed private equity investors, have just become, I think in the last decade, have become much more humble, much more sophisticated around how to work with some of the emerging smaller businesses, that they spot the talent and they want to invest in these businesses. 10, 15 years ago, I mean, their standard approach would be to just integrate everything. I feel like they've almost gone the other way, where they'd rather just behave as an investor and put some money in and take a seat on the board. And actually, even after they own more shares, occasionally they'll still run things like that, which I think is a great step forward, because often it's just a mismatch of scale that causes the problems. And I think big companies have realized that sometimes the best way to help some of these smaller businesses is to give them more space and allow them to remain entrepreneurial, and then help them in those areas that should really be for the smaller company to put their hand up and say, you know what, we're pretty rubbish at this and we could do with some help. Can you help us? And then the big company, usually they'll send in the cavalry because they do want to help, and that's great, but it needs to be sort of on the terms of the entrepreneurs, I think, rather than the big company trying to work out rather awkwardly how they can be helpful and perhaps getting it wrong and everyone feeling it's a bit awkward and not talking about it. So
life
has moved on well, I think.
I mean, it's really refreshing to hear that and to see that, because I think you do look sometimes, don't you? And Green and Black's a classic example, when you're like, you're absolutely flying, there's a brilliant culture, clearly things are working. Why would someone come in and take that away? I think the other thing that I really took from that was around sort of not letting things fester, and the way you said that sort of small bits have been building up over the last sort of couple of years. And actually, I think, So I'm sure many of our listeners, myself included, have like nowhere near the sort of scale as that, but have been through those moments where key people of a business have left, and it's left you feeling a little bit like, oh my word. And instantly you have that moment where you're kind of like, I either rebel against this and push back because I want the old team to come back, but then you realize that that's never going to happen. And by opening up and talking about it, it allows you to then work with that future team, rather than by festering on it, you go, oh, well, this person's done this and he must be awful. Whereas actually, it's majority of the time, it's not actually that person doing a thing. It's more the festered thought process that has kind of taken you through.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I mean, to put the record straight, there was some really wonderful people and characters that came across from Cadbury. Most of them fantastic advocates of the brand and great people. In fact, they're all great people. It's just, if there were a few flashpoints, it was more around that, I guess, kind of measurement and mismatch of approach, really, rather than anything else. But we probably could have solved, or I could have solved some of those things a little bit earlier, rather than just being wound up by them. So attacking things earlier on, and maybe they don't need to be such a flashpoint, is something I'll take from that and try and do better next time.
Yeah, fantastic. And then moving on to Pret.
Yeah, so Pret. So we started at Euro 96, and we're now kind of London 2012, just to set the scene.
Amazing.
So, happiest time in London from someone that's lived in London a while. It was a great vibe that summer. In terms of what I was doing at that stage, I'd embarked on a portfolio career. So I'd become involved with Causton Vale, as it was then, and we'd invested in that and turned it into Causton Press and started to hopefully make some good progress there. I had a few other clients. So I was trying to sort of earn a living as an entrepreneur and a consultant at the same time. And one of those clients was Pret, who'd recently gone through a change of ownership themselves into Bridgepoint Private Equity as their backers. But much of the Pret original management team had remained. And I felt kind of quite well placed to help them. I mean, they were, it was a much bigger business, but than Green and Blacks, but I recognized some of those dynamics. And I'd also been a Pret customer forever and probably would be my list of sort of all-time favorite brands. So the chance to actually go and do some consultancy work for Pret was a wonderful thing. So I did that. We got to know each other and like each other. And then they offered me the opportunity to become their marketing director, which wasn't kind of how I thought things would go. But I recently sort of we had two twin girls, and so family life was kicking in. I thought, actually, you know what, this is a bit of a once in a lifetime opportunity. Join an established big business as a marketing director, get paid properly, unlike my co-founder kind of phase when he didn't get paid at all. And felt like the responsible thing to do to get a proper job, and it was private equity backed to the chance of a good exit and all the rest of it. So I decided that I would take on the role and was very, very privileged to be asked to do that. But one of the conditions I tried to get as part of that was the ability to carry on my other activities. So that was being a non-exec at Union Coffee, where I've been involved for about 13 years now. The role at Causton Press, where I've been a co-founder, and you know, up until that point, I've been largely sort of running that business day to day, and then a team had joined over time. And I said to Pret, I don't want to give any of these things up, but I realise marketing director of Pret's not a 2-day-a-week job. And they said, well, how about we give you formal permission to do these other things. Maybe you could have half a day a week and we'll prorate your salary, divide by 5 times 4.5. And yeah, then you can do that. So I said yes to that, and tried to juggle it all, to be honest, for a period of time. And being marketing director of Pret is a very demanding job, and particularly in a phase when it's private equity backed and trying to grow really, really fast.
Yeah.
My role was in charge of marketing around the world, so there's a lot of travel involved as well. I was spending, our US business was trying to grow fast but not firing on all cylinders. UK business was doing well, but US needed a lot of attention. So for about 2 years, during my time at Pret, I was a week a month, I was in New York, where we were based.
Wow.
Doing that commute, young family, trying to kind of keep everybody happy, attending board meetings at Union, trying to stay close to Causton, going to weekly management meetings, darting out for 2 hours, almost feeling like I was being sort of disloyal to Pret by going to the meeting and then racing back. It was tough. And then I think there was a sense from a few people at Pret, is he really focused enough on Pret? Because he seems to be doing these other things. And believe me, I was doing them evenings and weekends rather than time.
Yeah,
but a bit of that going on in the backdrop. And then, I mean, Harry, you saw Causton at first hand, and that's a business I'm massively passionate about and have put a lot of time into. And I think there was a feeling, and certainly, Dan, who was our sales director at the time, I probably felt a bit let down in that I'd gone to do another job and you're not here anymore all the time, and I joined this business because you were here. And well, one of the reasons I joined it was because you were here and I wanted to work with you. And it just became a bit strained on multiple fronts. And I would say I just took on too much, and I thought I was a bit invincible and could do it all at the same time. And I realized that it wasn't making me very happy. And I felt that I was actually doing some, I think was doing, managing to do some good work, but there was probably a sense from my teams wherever I was involved that I was, not quite on it fully because of other interests. Yeah. Therefore, wherever you went, you felt you weren't totally nailing it. And I felt I was sort of letting everyone down a bit. And it's really hard, actually. And nothing to do with how hard I was working, because I was probably working every hour that God sent to do that. And it came to a bit of a head soon after I moved from being part-time to major time with the role at Pret. The girls were 18 months old, and unfortunately one of our daughters suddenly became very sick, totally out of the blue, and we found ourselves kind of in emergency mode with hospitals, and she was sent to Great Ormond Street where to try and get at the bottom of a very sudden and rare medical condition that she was diagnosed with. So had all that going on as well, really. And it was a pretty brutal time, and you realize that you're running just on pure adrenaline. And my style, I've always loved, I feel very lucky to do the work I do. I've always loved it. And I kind of, my solution was to just keep on working. And thankfully, my wife, who's Australian, so all of her family are back in Australia and we're not here, was able to, you know, take on a huge amount of strain and cope admirably with that, with my help as best I could whilst trying to keep all the work things juggling at the same time. And it was a really, looking back, quite a punishing period. And I think in some ways kind of work got me through it, but in other ways it kind of, you know, nearly broke me at the same time. So, you know, these tough moments are going on, and not everyone's always aware of what's happening. But that personally was the toughest time. And, you know, thankfully she made a recovery and is doing well. But it was an extremely, extremely difficult time and stressful time. And you look at your, I guess, support network at the time. And I think it's important to, when you're choosing a job and a role, I mean, people always say choose your company wisely, but try and choose the team that you're working with wisely as well. And I was very, very lucky at Prep. Prep was super supportive. Clive, who was the CEO, was very understanding and supportive, very privately, but didn't make a big deal of it. It was like a rock behind the scenes. And then a guy who was the creative director of Prep for many years, James Cannell, who was my right-hand man, really, in the marketing team, took on a huge amount of extra burden, really. And I was still there, but to be honest, I was kind of there in body, but not always kind of firing on all cylinders. And he took up a lot of the slack and led the charge, but in a way that he didn't make a big deal about that, but took on a lot of the pressure on my behalf. So was a fantastic colleague and, you know, has remained a great friend since, really. So you need to be, kind of need to have these superstar people in and around you. And I think wherever you work and in your life, you need to, hopefully you've got your friends outside of work, which I certainly had, but it's also very helpful if you've got some of those kind of star people in and around your work life as well, because you do need them sometimes to, you know, help you through certain tricky moments that maybe not everybody realizes you're going through, but you know, they did.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And they were fantastic support during that time. And I think the other, I guess that was a sort of a period of difficulty at Prep, but overall Prep was a massive success and the business sort of doubled, I think, during there or thereabouts during the time I was involved. And again, great exit at the end. We were brand of the year and the marketing team did some great work. And the one thing I always found difficult there was, I mean, I guess I kind of went to work. I never felt like the founder of Pret in the same way I did at Green and Blacks and Causton Press in LA and even Union. I felt like I was doing a job more at Press. I was very committed to it, but not as personally attached, perhaps as I've been with other brands. And anybody who has done a senior marketing role within hospitality and retail compared to FMCG will perhaps relate to the fact that, you know, marketing is not as well understood in those channels as it is in FMCG. I think FMCG, you're expected to lead the charge. You really are. You know, you're not just leading the charge, but to be honest, you are directing the brand and much of what the wider company does, working with other departments, but marketing's almost the, you know, leading the charge. And I think in hospitality and retail, it's often viewed more as a support function, and there's not a lot of understanding sometimes as to what marketing really does and how it does it. So that was tough. So the team were often under quite a lot of internal pressure, much of it unfair, I felt, for, you know, was the marketing as good as it could have been? Meanwhile, the external world were, you know, giving us awards left, right and centre because they realised how good it was. But inside the business, didn't always feel like it was totally understood. And that's a dynamic that's tough in a lot of companies, I think. You know, not just the example I give. Marketing, I mean, every function, you know, sometimes is, you know, not fully understood or appreciated. And there were moments of that at Prep. But, you know, we did some great work and I think it did work really well. So over time, I think they've realized, you know, they've realized the quality of the work the team did, particularly the creative work. And It's but yeah, that'd be another reflection on there. You don't always get the internal plaudits. Perhaps, you know, I've probably been used to that for too long, and then maybe they didn't follow in quite the same quantity. So that's a bit tougher to deal with. But if there's a learning from that, it's to, you know, retain your network outside of any particular business, your professional network. Yeah. And I would, you know, meet quite often, really, with not a large number of people, but with a few people from within the marketing world that were nowhere near the prep business that I respected and trusted. And they really helped bring a bit of perspective and talk to you about, you know, keep you on track, really, and encouraging you to do good quality professional work, even if it's perhaps not always kind of fully understood inside the four walls of the business. So always retaining an external network, I think, is important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, I mean, I really appreciate you coming on and being sort of so open and vulnerable through that experience. I mean, it must have been incredibly tough, and it's really inspirational to hear it. I also remember sort of going, I mean, you've been incredible to me and sort of held that mentorship role, in my eyes, that kind of mentorship role, where we've sat in prep a few times and had a cup of coffee. And I remember on each time we go, I'm just fascinated by nothing in that prep store gets past you. You'll see, like, even if it's from the way that they're repacking the shelves in the chiller, it's like, that shouldn't be like that. That can's the wrong way around that. And it's like, how you do everything at once is just unbelievable. And what really stuck with me there was that the difference between a kind of food service QSR environment versus a brand. And actually, from a marketing perspective, in prep, for example, I remember you talking about the photos and the images that went on the walls and whether they were the right type of images to be put on the walls and all that sort of stuff. And actually, from a brand, it's like, it's the product that sits on shelf, whereas in a food service environment, it's everything from the second the consumer steps inside the store. I find that fascinating, the difference between the two.
Yeah, and everything, you know, so everything is brand. Every single interaction or impression that a brand creates, good, bad, or ugly, it's a chance to inform their view of the brand. In hospitality, you're obviously delivering a brand through thousands of, you know, hardworking people on the front line. So how can you, as a marketeer, try and help them to be brilliant, really, and do their best for the brand, make life easy for them rather than more difficult? Well, it's very good of you to go for a coffee with me in a prep, Harry. My family have long since given up on that because it's so irritating.
I could imagine.
We wouldn't even get into going shopping in Waitrose or Sainsbury's or Tesco. I mean, that's even more. I have to go on my own because it always turns into a painful store check. But a few people relate to that.
It's always the way. And Mark, just as we start to wrap up, it'll be great to hear about sort of what's on the now. Like, obviously, you've mentioned Cause and Press and LA Brewery and obviously Union Coffee. Like, maybe give us a little bit of about those brands and what they're doing and what's on the future, just as we start to wrap up.
Sure. Well, having said to you to be careful not to take too much on, I guess I've probably ignored my advice completely on that. So I do a couple of non-exec things as well, which I'd like to mention. I mean, a business called Kestrel Foods, who I actually got to meet through Pret. They were one of the Pret suppliers based in Belfast, healthy snacks company, family owned, with a brand called Forest Feast, which hopefully you'll see more of soon. We've got lots of work underway on that brand to make a bigger splash in the GB market, as my friends in Belfast. So that's exciting. And always love working with family and privately owned businesses. So that's a good one to be involved with. A non-exec of Tisserand, which is a aromatherapy and wellbeing brand. So away from my first foray out of food and drink, but still similar customers.
Yeah.
The end. So that's a nice business and do particularly well at the moment, actually, as I think people's levels of anxiety and struggling to sleep and the like kind of benefit themselves of those products. So I have those two businesses. Union Coffee, I'm chair of Union now. Been involved, I'd say, nearly 14 years. Wow. I met them when I was at Green and Blacks, Jeremy and Stephen, the two founders of Union. It's been a great honour to be involved as a non-exec and as a helper to them on behind the scenes, really, for a number of years. But they have a fantastic team there. And a great business that has all. I always say they're like they're sort of the original B Corp. I think we're actually getting the official certification this year. Haven't got around to it yet. But actually, in terms of a business that walks the talk and does all the right things. They're out of the park on that. So that's great. And we had to pivot a lot in the last 12 months with the pandemic. Thankfully, we already had a grocery business and a D2C business up and running, but particularly the D2C channel with freshly roasted coffee direct to your home, whether you want it as whole beans or ground for your cafetiere or whatever piece of kit you've got at home, has proven to be extremely popular. So I'm brushing up on my direct consumer skills off the back of that business. LA Brewery, a lady called Louise Avery is the founder of LA, and William Kendall, who's my long-term business partner from Green and Blacks and Causton, and I teamed up with her to found LA Brewery 3 years ago. Again, a business has been battered by the pandemic. So just as we were getting sales going and starting to get some interesting distribution in hospitality, my master plan for LA Brewery was to not go into grocery, which doesn't look like the smartest strategy now, given everything that's happened in the last 12 months. But we're looking forward to the resumption of hospitality and supporting some of those customers as we come back. And we've just completed the $2 million fundraise on LA through various different financing. So we've got some fuel in the tank and are ready to give that a proper go. But Louise is a super talented lady who understands more than I will ever be able to around fermentation and how to get amazing flavour out of that type of brewing technique. So delicious craft, non-alcoholic drinks, but really grown up, exciting taste profiles and a big pipeline of MPD to come out of there. So that's sort of a flavour of some of the businesses. And of course, Causton Press, which is, so I don't do Green and Blacks or Pret anymore, but Causton Press is the, along with Union, is the longest tenure thing in my working life. So
amazing.
Still hugely, in fact, more involved than I have been for some time, actually, at Causton, working with Steve Frank and Joe Neal and the team there to try and give Causton the next level of kick as it goes on to its next sort of phase of growth. But team have done a storming job in the last 12 months after what was a very tough first couple of months of the pandemic, but have come back strong. So we've got a few new things coming there as well. So
fantastic.
That's exciting. And then I think that I probably need to find a couple of other things to do just to ensure a bit of distraction and light relief. The marketeer in me means I'm always thinking of new things, and then anybody sensible in my life tells me, please don't do anything else because you need to you please focus for once. It's much more interesting. But I think the excitement of the early stage business is definitely my my passion, really. So hopefully there was a press article the other week where William Kendall and I were both described as food industry veterans, which we both took that very badly.
So, I can imagine. I would not describe either of you as
haven't even been able to get my COVID jab yet, so that gives you a clue as to my age.
Yeah.
Hopefully there's a few more hits and experiences to come, and no doubt some bumps too, but it's a really exciting industry. I love being part of it, and particularly the smaller part.
Such an exciting portfolio of brands that you're involved in now. And I obviously, like, LA Brewery is absolutely delicious. I love Union, and obviously first hand sort of having worked at Causton as well. It's brilliant to hear. And in a real sort of pinch me moment now, without being too cheesy about it, but a real pinch me moment. I remember when walking into Causton on my first day there, and Dan Broughton set up a meeting for us. I remember meeting you in Pret and Victoria. So sort of 5-6 years on to have you on a podcast is a really exciting moment. And I've seen, just as the last bit as we wrap up, I've seen firsthand what a world-class act you are. And I'm not going to call you a veteran because you're definitely not, but I've seen firsthand like how fantastically you work. And I really appreciate you coming on, being so open, honest and vulnerable during this session.
Absolutely, Harry. It's good to see you doing your own thing. It's a very exciting time for you. So, we will try and help you behind the scenes as best we can. And we've had a few alumni from Causton Press, so the Dash guys as well. Great to see them doing so well. And,
absolutely.
Hopefully that's one of the things that can come from the networks that we all have, that there's some good shared experience and opportunities, and that people that have had some experience of working with some of the businesses like Causton that maybe are still a small business, but maybe it's a little further on than some, that people can.
Absolutely. Well, it's all credit to the management team for having that entrepreneurial environment to sort of allow, but I always describe it as my the university of FMCG working there, and just that being able to kind of have the confidence to go through, but also being able to learn from the management team. Anyway, I'm not going to keep.
That's good. We certainly don't miss your expense claims and your accruals coming in late every month. So, though the finance director has asked me to send his regards. But.
My admin definitely hasn't got any better. I'll tell you that now. Mariana will tell you firsthand that my admin has not got better.
Okay, well, there's always development areas for you, Mr. Tuck.
That's it, there we go. Fantastic. Well, look, Mark, thank you so much for coming on Untold. I really, really appreciate it.
Pleasure, great to see you. And
catch up soon.
Mariana. Okay, take care.
Take care, all the best.